Been on my back long enough, and it's about time to do something about it. As the grinding ever grinding screams of pain and misery echoing throughout the long hallways of time. Who's that knocking at my door? Who's that knocking at my door? Who's that knocking at my door? Cried the fair young maiden. Yo-ho, it's me from across the sea, said Barnacle Bill the sailor. Yes, grinding away, it's always 10:15. It's always Tuesday. Eternally, it's always. Oh, by the way, speaking of that, you know, it's I think one of the things that we have done in our modern offices is practically done away with the genuine milestones and the reminders and the pegboards of time. You know, very few offices today have clocks that you punch in with, you punch in there, because those clocks that you punched in on when you came into the office in a day of yore were very realistic. It reminded you of something very, very strongly. Thawing, another day. Another day. Oh, boy. You see, and what we do now in most offices and many places is we pretend that no days have ended, no days have begun. It's just as though it's a giant tape that flows on endlessly. Endlessly. Well, the thing about radio and other things that have to do with showbiz is that you are reminded that it is always 8:40. And the time in between one 8:40 and the next one is incredibly short. In fact, it seems like it's always 10:15, you know. Here it is, 10:15, 10:15. It's 10:15. All the time it's 10:15. Yeah. Have you noticed that radio stations, many of the more advanced radio stations, have eliminated time signals from the stations? They really have. You know, they're going the other way. Do you remember the stations continually? There's a couple down the dial yet, old-fashioned ones that are still lugging along with rock and roll music and stuff like that, you know, good guys and bad guys and in-between guys, and they keep saying, time now is 11:15, the temperature is 37 degrees, and they have not realized yet that people don't want to know what time it is. They really don't, you know. You see that great editor, the great, speaking of time and the ability that we have to erase reality from our existence, there was an ad that showed, recently, I think it was on the Saturday Evening Post, beautiful ad, you know, 8-color ad, and you see this bunch of people. It's a family. It's the typical American family ad group. Now, they don't look at all like people look like in life. There's a different look about the father's face. He has a sort of a crinkly smile, big white teeth, and you can't tell exactly how old he is. He looks like he's roughly 19 in some ways, and in other ways, he has the look of the seasoned elder about him. It's an ad man, you know, it's an ad father. And connected with him is the ad mother, who roughly looks like she's Audrey Hepburn's kid sister, is the ad mother. And the kids, of course, are there. They're the amorphous kids that can be almost any age, and they're aggressively children. You know that playing children today is a genuine technique and style, and as a matter of fact, is a profession among many professional performers. Have you seen those kids on those late night soup commercials on television? Those kids that are drawing that stuff, you know, what is it, that soup? They're hawking soup. There's another bunch of kids that are hawking toothpaste. Now, these kids don't act like any kids you ever saw. They're professional kids, which is a different kind of kid. They don't, you know, no kid ever has that cute look that those big teeth kids have in the soup ads. They don't have that kind of look. They're real kids, you know. They're real kids. Just You know what kids are like, but they're not like the ones in the ads. Well, then, on the other hand, are ingenues ever like women you've ever dated, actually? Is anyone in life ever like Mary Martin, actually, ever? Well, of course, this is all part of the whole business, but here's that beautiful ad. It's a 4, 8, 9 color ad, see, and it shows the ad family. And they're sitting around in this pine-paneled dining room in a very chic-looking restaurant. The guy with a green coat is serving them, and it says, "We can now afford to dine out." And I think it's a pitch, you know, for a diner's club or something. It says, "We can now afford to dine out." What it turns out when I get down at the bottom there is that they have all gone out the week before and they have bought their plots. They've gone out to their local final security haven and have bought their plots for the entire family, and now they're secure enough that they can afford to dine out. Gee whiz, you know. Hi, George, the Four Seasons never thought of that one. I along the line there, I figured, you know, that's an interesting concept of security. It's exactly, of course, you know, every man has to pick his own way. Captain Ahab said that. A few other guys said it. You got to stand on the prow of your own boat. You have to pursue your own white whale. And how are you doing with time lately? I mean, how do you see time? You see it as not existing? Or is it just a part of a machine there at the clock? Is the thing pointing there. And it just goes around. The hand just keeps going round and round and round. And you just, you know, it's an abstraction. It's an interesting kind of abstraction, though. It's, some people say it doesn't exist at all, you know. There's an entire school of physical thought. We're getting into the realm of not only psychology, philosophy, and or higher math here, that says time does not exist except in the mind of man. There's no such thing as time. But here's an example now. Now, is there time at all to an object that is unerodible or inerodible? In short, if you can conceive of an object that does not erode, now the sun does, so does the moon, so do most elements we know. Does time exist to an element or to an object that does not erode? Is there such a thing as time, then? If there is an unchangeable thing, it's just a totally unchangeable, completely, or billions and billions of years. You see, time is based on change. Time is based on an expanding universe, or a contracting universe, or an exploding molecule, or a defeated man, or any one of a thousand things. Is there such a thing, literally, as time, though? Give me my giant sound of time rattling its change throughout all eternity music, please. Oh, boy, that's time rolling like a fantastic stone down the mountain of eternity. And there you are at the bottom of it all. We're clinging to a rock. Oh, there's no grass grows under the feet of time. Boom. Ah! Help! Help, help! Stop it. Oh. Boy, that's scarier than a WABC time signal. I'll tell you, it's a scary thing. I mean, this business of time. Of course, time. Then what people try to do is they try to put time in a nice, clean, beautiful, harnessable package. Somehow, if you can put time, if you can label things, if you ever had this feeling that if you label something, you somehow feel better about it. You really do. Even the worst conceivable things. And so if you can put a label, it's the thing you can't label that bugs you. And there are many things you cannot label. That's why we have to put a guy in, almost anybody we hear on the air or see or watch performing, we have to put them in a category. Here is a liberal. Here is a conservative. And the minute they're labeled, you feel better about it. You would feel far more happy around a guy you know is a communist than you would about the unlabelable. This is a guy that is not about to be labeled at all, and any minute now is going to go in any direction. You would feel much better with the clown. In short, you feel better with a definable enemy, literally an enemy you know is your enemy. And so we have this insane desire to label, and one of the things that we want to label more than anything else is time. We really want to label time. because if we can label it, it doesn't seem as dangerous. It does not seem as unmanageable. Really, it seems as though somehow you can do something about it, especially if you can divide it into milliseconds. And the minute you can put it down in, on tapes, you know, and the minute you can start making long tapes, you can cut up and you slice it, and you have machines that measure it, and you know, all of a sudden you have calendars that have girls' pictures on it. It seems very manageable. It really does. It seems like all you got to do is just tear it off. You know, tear off the sheet, and that's it. And you're in the next one. Now here we are. We're on the threshold of another April. Or has it already arrived? Is it tomorrow? 2 hours. What was it that T.S. Eliot said about April? April is the saddest month, or the most dangerous month. Which is it? It's something anyway. But that doesn't make any difference. We're not here to quote T.S. Eliot. The facts of the matter are that no matter where you go, even in the most primeval of tribes, they tried to conquer time. They tried to put it into a shape. They invented calendars. And they said, it is now February. And there was a sense of achieving something. Have you ever had the feeling that every month that comes up, you have achieved another month? It is now, by George, it's April, you know. Oh, I never thought it would come. Well, it'll go, too, you know. And each succeeding month marches past, and you have a vague, sort of almost undefined, you can't define it, a sense of climbing up a ladder or something. You know, each month is a kind of an achievement, and you have made another step. Now, have you? Has anything happened at all, except that the sun has gone around the earth? Does that have any bearing on you? Is there any such thing as that? This is a discussion. Of course, you know that even our politics is based on this. Everything man does is based on time. The unconscious admission that he is not going to be here long. The unconscious admission that there were guys here before and who are no longer here. And the unconscious admission that there will be other guys around after you are not here. People use these phrases like the future. They use these phrases like the future, and then they say things like posterity. They say, you know, all these various things, which literally say that we are conscious of something. We are conscious of being in a big sea of some kind of liquid or fluid or moving. Do you imagine time as a fluid or a liquid or something? Do you imagine it as a ribbon, a road? Pretty interesting problem, you know. And speaking of problems, this is WOR, AM and FM, New York. Your friendly problem station. We bring up things that nobody else dares to mention. And you can see why we're running 18th in a field of 19 in the ratings. But that's all right. That's all right. We're honest and reliable, although muddle-headed. We admit to that. Good old friendly 19th century thought here. We're putting it out hourly on the hour, every minute, grinding it out like so many long yards of summer sausage. Excuse me. Well, that's all right, you know. There's a place. You're just lucky that we're not turning out 14th century thought. Then you'd be scared. Some thoughts that drifted around in the 14th century that would really curl the hair in your ears if I started to lay it out. And I could do it. Although from time to time, you see, the thing is we are mixtures of all these things. There is a distinct 12th century element that runs through me. There's no question about it. There is an element of the Gothic that I cannot escape. Then, of course, there is also an element of probably the 95th century that runs through me. They will be hearing the echoes of that then and wondering how it all came about. Well, it came about because of all of us. You know, Ed Sullivan, the whole crew, we added it. We added to the melange. Everything builds on the past. And falls on the past, I might also add, too. And so, you know, where do you go? Now, of course, the concept of progress is also based on time. We refer to progress. We are moving from point A to point who knows what. And it is progress. This is called progress. Now, can you imagine such a thing as progress divorced from a concept of time, literally? Time is the thing. Time is the only thing that everyone universally acknowledges. A lot of people don't acknowledge sex. They just refuse to concede it. Many people refuse to concede rain. I've known people who won't even admit to it. I've known people who've said, you know, who'll look you right in the eye and say, this is not a plague of locusts. These are just small bugs. Well, and the locusts are eating the tar paper right off the roof of the garage. It doesn't matter. I know you just can't. But time, nobody argues about. Not one guy will refuse to admit that it is now Tuesday. And yesterday it was Monday. And you go to Nigeria, they know about time there. They've conceded that everywhere you go. Now, I was reminded about this thing. It was a very, you know, you can get very philosophical. You can get almost numbingly philosophical about time. Yes, it is. It makes your head spin and buzz and makes your mouth taste like old cakes of yeast and stuff. I remember when I was about 9, kids do this, you know. I'm sure that there are a lot of grown-up type people listening to me and say, what's this idiot talking about? When's this guy going to grow up? Well, now it is true that children do actually concern themselves with these giant questions. They soon learn to give that up. A kid of 9 looking up at the Milky Way will often say, and they do, I remember doing it. You remember this, Al. They'll look up and they'll say, what's past the Milky Way? And then somebody will say, well, you know, there's another galaxy there. And you say, well, what do you mean there's another? What's beyond that? And then you keep asking those questions, and then finally somebody will say, well, it expands. That stops it right there. That somehow has to do with the theory of refrigeration, which you never could quite understand, and that's the end of that. You just walk away. And eventually, you concern yourself with things which you know that you can handle almost, like paying for, you know, 5 gallons of gas. This is a problem that you can deal with. You can call up somebody and tell them that you're not coming tomorrow night. You can deal with that. And eventually, we cover ourselves up with a giant collection of things, movements, and acts, which are, in a sense, a kind of ducking of some of the major issues. Now, getting back to this thing of time, would you please, yes, give me my giant, hold it there, Al. I think I will need my giant time music. I don't know how I get on these mailing lists. I think in the end, a man will be judged eventually on the kind of mailing list he gets on. I've just gotten on an unbelievable mailing list. I don't know what they know about me, but they certainly scored big with this one. Listen to this now. Are you all right? Wait a minute here. Let's get this already out here. Georgia, let's just get done with this thing here. Let's see. Wait a minute here now. I've got to get my invitation out here. It's an invitation. I don't get many invitations. I'm one of those people. And this is a very important invitation. I'm going to stick with this one. Where is it here? Yes, here it is. Right here. It tells me to throw it away if I don't intend to use it. So this invitation has been sent to you exclusively here, and I'm very exclusive. Let's see. Yes, all right, are you all ready for that now? This is one of the most, in a very real way, one of the most reassuring pieces of mailing that I've gotten in a long time. And I would like to pass it along to you. I wish I could say this. Yes, it's in the colored brochure that's included. See, I'll tell you why I like it. It's because Haile Selassie also got a copy of this in the same mailing list. It says right here. Yes, I'm not alone, you know. There's a lot of great guys in this world that have got this same thing. All right, so here it comes now. All right, I'm sitting here very, you know, naturally. I'm opening up the mail. I get the thing from the phone company, and I get the one from the answering service. And I got the 1,700 letters from the old ladies out in Queens, which I file. And I'm going through all of my stuff, and all of a sudden I get this great big beautiful one here, and it's got the stars, and it's got the clouds and the moon. It's got everything on it, and I open it up, and give me that music there. Oh, boy! That's time marching past my desk. An important fact about the registered invitation enclosed. The valuable invitation enclosed. It is registered in your name alone. Offers a remarkable opportunity to enjoy for 10 days in your own home a free demonstration of the world famous Atmos. the clock favored by royalty and knowledgeable people throughout the world. If you are unable to use the invitation, please destroy it, for it is issued to you personally. Now, you are invited to enjoy the magnificent Atmos clock in your home for 10 full days free. The one possession you can confidently expect to become a true family treasure and heirloom. The only possession you have which will guarantee to be lasting forever and ever. Atmos clock is owned by H.E. Winston Churchill, former Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, Mr. Willie Spuler, President of Switzerland, H.M. Haile Selassie, Emperor of Ethiopia, His Majesty the Shah of Persia, His Majesty the King Paul of Greece, H.E. Boigny, President of the Ivory Coast, H.E. Gnanchi, former president of Italy, and the H.M. Prince Alexander of Yugoslavia, all are marching down the same road with you. With the same perpetual motion, unwearable, atomically engineered clock. Control time. By the way, hold it there. I thought, you know, I ought to send one of those to my mother. No, I'm very thrilled that these people realize that I'm worried about time, and it's the most unusual clock utilizes a principle of perpetual energy discovered in 1760 by James Cox. In that year, the first crude model of this Atmos type clock was built. It was complicated and extremely costly. It took over 200 years of science to refine Mr. Cox's efforts and to transform his dream into the reality of today's modern Atmos. Now, I am, of course, Atmos is a Greek word, and it has to do with eternity. And Atmos. It has to do with the ultimate. The smallest particle, it has to do, really, with the nature of the universe itself. Atmos. Atmosphere, atom. Atomic. And, it's nice to be attached to things that are solid and reliable like that, if only for $125. It runs steadily and has a 10-year guarantee. Now, so I don't like the idea of a perpetual motion clock that only has a 10-year guarantee, but... of course, we do define eternity in rather short terms these days. I remember one time I bought a ballpoint pen when they first came out. They were supposed to be guaranteed for a lifetime. Well, about 26 days later, mine ran out of gas and began to just scratch on the checks. And I wrote back to the place, and it seems that they were out of business and had moved to Peru. And they're now in, I believe it's the oil industry. That same outfit with my quarter, or was it a dollar and a quarter? Was it $40? I remember they were very expensive. Do you remember them? But then the idea of this clock, I cannot get out of my mind, because I think the concept, you know, that there are very comforting shops throughout Britain. We have not yet arrived at this state. This is one of the reasons why people have a secret delight in royalty. Royalty somehow gives them, in a very real sense, a flesh and blood attachment with what appears to be time itself. And so if you walk past Queen Elizabeth II, there is a sense you're also walking past Richard III. There is a direct connection with Hunrath the Bald, with Ethelred the Scaly, and perhaps even the very earliest guys who crawled out of the cave, and the first one said, "I am Charlie the Lantern-Jawed, and I am the chief in this neighborhood." I wonder how the first king, by the way, was crowned. but this is one of the secret, really one of the genuinely secret lures of royalty. It has nothing much to ever really to do with a father figure, but it has to do with time itself, the dynastic concept. It's very important. And as a country grows older and it begins to cure all of its basic problems, like chopping down the trees and getting rid of the skunks, and growing enough radishes so everyone can have a sandwich and all that stuff, then it begins to worry about other things. It begins to look around, and it begins to conceive of itself now as a finished product. Now, in the very earliest days of England, of course, they did not have a king. They just had a lot of guys scratching, because there were woods there. There were bears. You know that England at one point was very heavily wooded. It was a very tough country. Some writers have written about it in those days. And it was a true frontier. In those days, they didn't have any need for kings. They just needed a lot of stone axes and stuff. And they proceeded to get them. Well, then, eventually, of course, they paved everything. Lord Beaverbrook came along and a few other things in England. And then they definitely had a need for an attachment with the past. And even countries which pride themselves on being materialistic countries are insanely involved in it. They can't get away from it. Have you ever been in Moscow? Well, let me tell you, Moscow. In Moscow, the echoes of the past are everywhere, and they preserve them. Long lines of people standing in front of a building, a little squat building, to look at the tomb of Lenin is an interesting sight. Why are they looking at Lenin? Well, one reason is it gives them a sense that in spite of the fact that everyone's working at the tractor plant, that they are connected with somehow the past. And the more a country wants to cut itself off from the past, the more nutty it gets about preserving these things, where we have this wonderful little schizoid split down there. And I suspect that more and more America, if you notice around you, more and more the hipper the person is, the more he is prone to collect objet d'art from the World's Fair of the St. Louis World's Fair Exposition of 1893. Exceedingly hip, he reads the Reporter magazine, he plays the kazoo and buys Bob Dylan records, all singing about the 1890s. Bob Dylan records are constantly singing about building the Union Pacific, or somehow doing away with the bread lines of the 30s. The Woody Guthrie syndrome is very, very prevalent in America today, and it happens to be 1964. I'm sorry, Woody. It's 1964, and the PWA is no more. But nevertheless, we are now beginning to encapsulate, to put in little capsules, seal into our memory our own rather skimpy past. Now, we have a skimpy past, and somehow the real past of America is too remote for us. Very few people today make much of a deal about, let's say, the Whiskey Rebellion. I don't know anyone who's collecting objet d'art of the Whiskey Rebellion, although I don't know whether there are many of them around. Hardly anybody talks about the good old days of the War of 1812. However, people really are hung up on things which are comparatively recent history, but to a world like our world, which has cut itself off literally from the flow of time, it seems like an infinite, almost an incredible distance in the past. And so people will collect Little Orphan Annie shake-up mugs that were given out by Pierre André, the way other civilization collects, say, Etruscan vases. I have a friend who has a whole wall full of very valuable objet d'art. Literally, one of his prime pieces is a library table runner. It's a great paisley shawl that says on it, "Souvenir of Whispering Bridge, Virginia." And Whispering Bridge, Virginia, and it has a picture of an Indian on it. And underneath it, it says 1934 in big letters. And he's very proud of this. And to him, this is a piece of ancient art. It represents his tie with the past of Virginia. I don't think he's ever been to Whispering Bridge, Virginia, but that doesn't matter. The thing is that he's connected with the past, and that's very important. and he keeps this thing out there. Now, the things that we cannot... probably the most significant evening I've spent along this line, if I can use such pompous words as significant, is a friend of mine who owns a big, swinging, multi-billion-dollar magazine that is totally based on the here and now. This magazine is based on the now. In fact, nobody in the magazine is even conceded to have any age at all. They do not have any age. It's a male magazine. Nobody ever refers to anybody as having any age at all in the magazine. They're completely involved in the now, the swinging now. And yet, this guy's house, which is a fabulous house, is decked out with 15th century German armor. The real Teutonic Knight armor. This is not the stuff that you get from Brooks Costuming. This is the real stuff, you know. It's a little bits of dried blood, and you can see boar's fangs hanging on it. The real thing, you can see where the maces have bounced off the scuttles, and the whole. And he's got it in his house. And this guy, his magazine is dedicated to the now, but he lives right next to one of Ludwig's forebears. He sits there, and he's not German. That's what's so fascinating about it. He's looking for any past. He just clings to anybody's past and hangs on to it. And there he sits. Now, throughout Bucks County, it's harder to find a gas station than to find for every gas station in Bucks County, there are 34 antique shops. Believe me, it is easier to find a piece of Paul Revere silver than a hamburger in Bucks County when you really need one. This is a new thing, and people, of course, all pretend it's because of the beautiful workmanship. Some of this stuff is incredibly ugly, viewed from any possible aesthetic standard. But when you're viewing it through the peculiar clouded inverted glass of looking at time itself, it becomes beautiful, and time is beautiful. As long as it's safely controlled and is there in the shape of a colonial rocking baby's bed, a rocking crib, and you feel very good about it because it's somehow controllable. It's over there, and you can buy it and sell it. You own it, and you feel comfortable about it. I just wonder how long it will take before little antique shops have opened up. And they are selling genuine chic razors, the electric AC/DC model, and they are being sold as pieces of an ancient, wonderful, soft, warm past. Have you ever gone down on 4th Street and walked in the old used bookshops down there? Now, these are not used bookshops. This is something else again. There's a place down there that I happen to, I'm a great fan of it. It's up on about the third or fourth floor. One day it's all going to burn down, I'm sure, but it's on about the third or fourth floor, and it's an entire block square. And it is just filled, not with with collectors, just old books. They are bought and sold by the ton. And they are just old books. And you walk around in the old books, and there's one whole department just called Geography. And you walk around there, and you see this endless amount of work guys have done in, let's say, 1895, and they have written a piece on, let's say, Somerset County, Kentucky, the geography and the geological formations, including interesting steel engravings of the caves to be found around Louisville. And you get this thing out, you know, and there's a picture of a guy poling his boat through an underground river in the Lesser Mammoth Cave just outside of Louisville, holding a lamp up. You know, you look at this thing, and somehow you feel warm about it. You know, you feel good. You walk around in there. And more and more, the book sellers down there will tell you that there is a great growing influx of people who are wandering around just buying old bad books. Now, they're not buying collector's items. They're not buying things which cost $45. They're not buying first editions of The Hunting of the Snark or anything like that. These people are just buying books like A Papillote and The Tittering Totem. They're buying things like The Outdoor Chums at the Lake. And they take these and they polish them off. And of course, they can't read them. You couldn't read it. It's just they're badly, terrible, terrible sources. Ned, the fun-loving outdoor chum, shook his fist at Dan Baxter and said, "You will pay for this, Dan Baxter." And, of course, you can't read it for 30 cents, but you can own it somehow. You're owning a chunk of something that is controllable, and it is very, very harmless. And that's the most important point. Very harmless. Nothing is more harmless than to own a muzzle-loading pistol from, say, the War of 1812. I happen to own one. It feels good to hold it in my hand. The only time I worry is when I have in my hand an M14 gas-operated Garand. That you know, that's an objet d'art that worries me somehow. I don't know why. It's the same thing. You know, it bothers me. One doesn't, the other does. Literally true. You can go down. No, really. What is the difference between these two things? One is controllable. One is not. Speaking of the uncontrollable past, which it often is. Do you remember the story of a very famous singer in America? I will award you a brass figligy if you can remember this piece of Americana triviana. A very famous singer who was, in his day, bigger than Presley, had a collection of guns, ancient, antique, old, moth-eaten guns, and they were up on his wall. He had hundreds of them. And one day, he was there with a friend of his, and he took this old pirate pistol down. It was an old muzzle-loading pirate pistol that was from England, I believe, or France, and he was showing it to this guy. It was about 400 years old or more. He was showing it to him, and he turned it around, and he was showing it to this guy, and he dropped it, and boom! For 400 years, this thing had been loaded, and it went off right between the eyes. And do you remember the story? He was killed instantly. Nobody could believe it. He literally was a very famous singer and movie star. And for the rest of his life, or excuse me, not his life, but the rest of the life of the family, his mother was never told this, and she was sent letters from various members of the family that he was out traveling all around. You know, he was in Hollywood, he was here, and for 30 years she kept getting letters about him. So you really can't escape the past. You just can't. I know a guy who not more than about a year ago, funny thing, this guy, in fact, this is a story that has been told. You know that recently, a friend of mine just did an article on buried shells in and around Gettysburg. And do you know, within just a comparatively recent time, guys were constantly being blown up when they were... when they were plowing in the area of the Civil, boom, up would go this this thing, and the guy would get blown up. He was the last victim of the second charge of Pickett's number 2 rifleman on the Big Ridge, you know, and he got blown up. And this goes on and on, so you never really can quite escape it. I don't know whether we ever really want to. I think there's always a very quiet, secret satisfaction that somebody is still getting blown up by mini balls that were fired at Bull Run. It kind of makes you feel that they're still alive, you know. That in itself is vaguely. Now, did you read this piece? There's a piece in speaking of the idea of beating the whole concept of time itself. There is a book out now that tells you on how you can preserve your life. It's a book, see, and it starts out, literally, now don't laugh, I'm telling you the truth. It tells you what you need is a tape recorder. And it tells you how to record all the various things of your life, how you tell people all about yourself, and you're supposed to play a record, your favorite record, you get out a record, you record this on the tape, and all the various things. You talk about reminiscences of your boyhood, and the book tells you how to do it. It says, describe what you thought of your Uncle Fred, and you say that, and you go on. In short, it is literally a biography in sound, an autobiography in sound. Now, this is a new kind of ego. It's a very new kind of ego. That great men have always had that kind of ego. They figure that when they've got to put their life down on paper so that everyone will know this great man lived. Everyone's afraid that no one will know it. This is really the concern. And, of course, this is a tacit admission, again, about time, that there will be guys come afterwards who will wonder, whether there really was a Charles Wellington Witherspoon who lived on the Grand Concourse. You know, they really want to know. And so, sure enough, they can take down from the great vast file of tapes, they can take down Charles W. Witherspoon's own voice and play it 1,000 years from now. They'll play it. And he said, you see, I was a Met fan, and, I walked around, and I liked it when it rained, you know. I'd look at the rain, and, and he had nothing to say, but by George, 1,000 years from now, they'll be playing his tape, and somehow that'll be a great thing, and it really will be, literally. I would love to have a tape of a nothing Roman, of a real nothing Roman, you see, who barely knew there was even a guy named Caesar. That the average citizen of today is very hard-pressed when you try to ask him who the president is, he might know. Ask him who a vice president is, he's confused, you see. He says, well, wait a minute now, wait, it's Johnson. He said, no, it's not Johnson. Well, it's a very unfair question. He said, well, who is the Secretary of State? Secretary of State, Stevenson, and that's a state of Lodge. Well, you know, you just forget it. The average man is not involved in anything but walking around and scratching and blowing his nose and once in a while yelling at other guys at the stoplight, and that's about it, you know? Well, well, you put this on tape, and I think you might have a profound testament. I literally do. I think you might really know something about the way it was in this time. Put Edward R. Murrow's reminiscences on, and I don't think you get anything. You get a lot of, you know, this is the reason I got to be a famous man. I thought good thoughts, and I don't know. I would love to have a tape, really would. I would like to have a tape of just an ordinary, run-of-the-mill guy who worked on one of the smaller pyramids in the Valley of the Kings. Not even the Great Pyramid at Giza, just one of the smaller ones. And you know, he's talking about what it's like, and you ask him about the pharaoh. Well, he doesn't even know who's pharaoh right now. Well, let's see, which one is in now? Three. The last year he died, yeah, I remember, sure. Yeah, it's the tall one, yeah. Yeah, Ra. And you say, well, what do you think of Ra? You know, Ra, this is the great... Well, I guess there's something to that, yeah. Yeah, I don't know. Well, you know, you never know. I always say you never know. I don't know. Is some god? I don't know. Did you ever hear of Cleopatra? Who? Cleopatra. Sure. I remember in school we read about her. Yeah, I remember. Yeah. Well, what do you think of that? Did you ever hear of Mark Anthony? Anthony. No, that's not an Egyptian name. What is it? That sounds Jewish, is it? No, that's... Anthony, no. No. Oh, yeah, you've tried... And you'd go on and on, and you'd really know what it was like in the shadow of one of the lesser pyramids. You know, they walk around, it rains. And you hope that the rye bread comes through on time, and that's about the extent of it. Well, now what are... You know, it's the fight against time. The Charles W. Witherspoon does exist. He did, anyway. And there is this... Oh, one thing, you know what the book tells you to do? Believe it or not, it tells you to stay away from controversial discussions. It literally does. It tells you to stay away from that. It tells you to stay away from family arguments. It says do not discuss religion or politics. So Charlie can be non-controversial all the way into the 28th century.
This is WOR.